And now I'll ask Daniel to continue. So you need this stuff, right?
Five slides, and it seems the first one is already redundant. It's fairly obvious that it would be. Yeah, so I will talk briefly, I hope, about the music technology track in the project and the current state of the outcome. I will not focus very much on the technology itself, but rather on artistic and conceptual issues related to this track. The goal of the music technology track was and still is to use machine learning algorithm to categorize movements of performers in real time, and to use this kind of information both in the context of the other tracks of the project. So the most tangible outcome is a software that we have developed. It's called the Machine Learning Workbench, ML Workbench. And this software provides the means to analyze in real time or offline sensory data and to process this data via single or multiple machine learning pipelines. And the workflow of the software is geared mostly towards the artistic practice part of the project, but also towards the music psychology part. So in music psychology, it is meant to be usable as a quant to do statistics or other quantification of survey results, and in artistic practice it's meant to be useful for designing interactive systems that connect performers to, for instance, live electronics. Yeah, the people in the project, Jan has already said it, Chikashi Miyama has been doing most of the implementation. Jan has sort of has the overview of the activities and has been involved in the artistic practice part of using the software, and I have been a mixture of advising on the machine learning side, and doing some small implementation. Yeah, so very briefly concerning the software itself. It has been developed using Open Frameworks as a toolkit. It allows to read in sensory data and process this sensory data via machine learning algorithms that are specialized for gesture classification. So the sensory data itself can be offline, being read in from a file, it can be online, coming in via OSC or serial communication. Then you get, how do you get the mouse pointer here? You see in the second row from the top, the plot that's directly the plot of the sensory data. So you can inspect the sensory data, you can define segments, use these segments to create a training set, and then this training set will be used to train the gesture recognition algorithms. So and once they have been trained, you can then feed all the sensory data through this whole pipeline and get classification results, which are shown by these colored bars, and you also get some kind of likelihood of that the classification is correct. The software can be controlled remotely by OSC, and you can also get the sensor data and the classification results sent to your software via OSC, for instance, to MaxMSP or to SuperCollider. Yeah, the machine learning algorithms that we have integrated, these are existing implementations of fairly well-known algorithms. Most of them are from the GTK toolkit, is that correct? The one by Julian. Yeah, so, and the other one is a gesture variation follower that we're using. And we might want to include more later on, maybe. So, now I move on to creative applications of this software. So the idea is to use the software in order to control interaction between a musical live performer and electronics or computer-based music. And the main reason that this kind of software is attractive to us is that machine learning applications allow you to train systems with higher level cues than just low level sensory information. And this gives the interactive system sensing capabilities that are more related to the way that human beings perceive movement or assess quality of movement. Yeah, so there are a bunch of examples what you could do with our software. And I will then focus on the last example because it's the one that has been most prominently used by us. So for instance, you could build an intelligent cue system that triggers certain musical events based on the classification of gestures. You could build an adaptive mapping algorithm that relates movement to musical control parameters. Or you could use the machine learning algorithms to create a generative system. To create a system that has a certain musical autonomy that could be used sort of as an improvisation partner in a performance. And that's what we have been looking into, both as part of case studies, practical case studies within the project, and also as part of some reflections about what we could do with machine learning. So this is a performance you will see this evening, I think. So yeah, it's also redundant than the slide. Double Vortex is one of two case studies, and it's a piece for trombone and live electronics. And the idea is that the machine learning algorithms acts not only as a gesture classifier, but also as a generative system, in the sense that it provides the live computer parts a certain degree of freedom and spontaneity when responding to the activities of the trombone players. So the sensory data are based on IMU. I should probably also mention that. The sensory data that we have been using with the machine learning toolbox so far is mostly motion capture and IMU data. And that's complementary in the sense that motion capture gives you a spatial and allocentric point of view versus IMU sensors, body-worn sensors, give you a kinetic and egocentric point of view. So in this performance, we have been using IMU sensors that are attached directly to the trombone. And they are both used in order to create a training set of basic movements, six movement primitives that are fairly common in trombone playing. And they're also used to control the parameters of some audio post-processing effects in the live electronics part. The content of the live electronics part consists of audio samples that are being recorded live from the trombone playing. And the triggering of this recording and the triggering of the playback is controlled by the classification results of the machine learning algorithms. The system is generative in the sense that the machine learning algorithm has been modified, or at least the parameterization has been chosen in such a way that they no longer produce classifications that are fully predictable. So there is a certain degree of uncertainty and therefore a certain degree of spontaneity in how the system responds, and therefore for the audience that allows them to attribute a sort of limit level of autonomy to the system. The machine learning algorithms that we have been using here are the dynamic time warp algorithm and the gesture follower, variation follower algorithm. The DTV algorithm is used to trigger audio playback. There are two versions running in parallel. One that has a lower sensitivity threshold for gesture recognition, one that has a higher sensitivity threshold. And they also differ in the kind of samples that trigger. So the lower threshold algorithm triggers shorter samples and the longer samples. And the gesture variation follower is used to control the recording of the trombone output. So these algorithms are complementary in the sense that the dynamic time warping algorithm can only provide a classification once the gesture has been finished. And the gesture variation follower gives you sort of an online classification while a gesture being executed. So there's also differences in timing. Yeah, so the result of the setup is as follows, that the audio output of the live electronics part is partially disconnected from the live input by the trombone player. And this creates sort of a quality of a second voice for the live electronics. So The voice imitates or mimics some of the sonic qualities, or most of the sonic qualities of the trombone output, But the timing is different, the predominance of certain segments in this audio output is also different. So, and this is my last slide, which is more of a speculative nature. So I try to argue that machine learning algorithms are very interesting in order to build generative systems that can be used sort of as improvisation polymers in live performance context. And so in order for such a system to be useful as an improvisation polymer, it has to mimic certain human capabilities. And the most obvious ones I could come up with is or this 1, 2, 3, 4. The system should be sensitive to the specific context of the performance, obviously. Then it should respond to cues within this context that are similar in the sense that also humans and audiences recognize their cues. So that they should respond to high-level cues that are understandable by human beings. It should combine active, proactive activities and more like reactive activities. And it should have sort of idiosyncrasy to its behavior. So it should have sort of a musical personality in order to stand out from the rest of the performance. So, of course, I could, to phrase that a little bit different, these capabilities, you could say that the system should have both some sort of agency and subjectivity. Agency in the sense that it's aware of its environment, that it can affect the environment proactively, and subjectivity in the sense that its behaviors are characteristic for this particular system and they are self-motivated. Yeah, so machine learning algorithms, due to the fact that they can be trained with more or less arbitrary patterns, are lend themselves for the realization of the capabilities 1, 2 and 4, I would say. So if a machine learning algorithm is trained with cues from a particular performance context, then the system obviously becomes sensitized to that performance context. And if the cues from this context are high-level cues, they are recognizable by human beings as well, then the system, at least the triggering conditions that initiate behavior on the generative system, are comprehensible by the human performers and the audience. And concerning point four, so if a system, generative system, is created from machine learning algorithms, then you have sort of at least three aspects that feed into its characteristics. First of all, you have always the design decisions of the creator of the generative system that affect its properties. Then you have the particular capabilities and limitations of the machine learning algorithm. And in addition to that, you have the very specific quality of the cues that are used in the training set, and they are shaped by the performance context in which these cues are generated and by the performer who creates these cues. So you have sort of an amalgamation of these three aspects that shape the particular identity of the generative system. And then concerning point three, there are a bunch of possibilities that you could use machine learning algorithms to fulfill this balance between proactive and reactive behaviors. As I have said concerning double vortex, one of the most obvious and simpler approaches would be that you modify the gesture classification algorithm in such a way that they are no longer fully predictable, so that the audience has a tendency to attribute a certain degree of autonomy compared to what's happening on the stage. Alternatively, or in addition, it might be interesting if the gesture classification or the training is extended into the performance phase, which we haven't been doing so far. The training happened before the performance. So the system would gradually change in its behavior over the course of the performance and therefore deviate from its initial settings at the beginning of the performance, which would also sort of contribute to its level of autonomy. And then maybe most interestingly, but also most difficult to realize, would be that the system, the output of the system is added to the training set itself. So the training is ongoing, and at the same time the system engages in some sort of self-observation, and this self-observation would then shape the behavior of the system in a manner that's truly independent from a human designer. Yeah, so I would like to close with this last, most challenging approach, and maybe move on to discussions.
Okay, so I'm aware that this is jumping in at the deep end, so to speak. It's fairly technical, but in a way it's an interesting area to investigate in terms of linking technological processes. So I'm talking of sound generating processes or mapping processes. And it's something I've been interested in for a very long time, is how to make the connection actually dynamic. Because of course we all know that the computer needs to be told everything to do, basically. And that makes it very static in a way. The relationships become very static. And so the interest in using machine learning for the algorithm, for a generative aspect, what you call the generative system, is actually to give some agency to the computer, so that the technology itself starts shaping what we perceive. And that was part of the investigation in both artistic pieces that we're going to see tonight, was to find the balance of how much can the computer actually influence how the sound and the actions are related. So my questions now in a way are, I think we've really just scratched the surface here, and in a way we haven't invented anything. So I think that has to be said very clearly, that we're applying existing tools, but the investigation has more been on a kind of conceptual and application level of how can these things be applied to the practice. Because as far as I know, most of the research, I mean, machine learning in general is being done for like database, data mining, finding certain patterns in huge amounts of data that we have. And in music performance, it's being used up to a certain point. And of course, we're within a context of what you, Alexander, and Atau are doing. Fred also is not here. I mean, we're kind of contextualizing that.
I think the main contribution on the artistic side is really to this idea of integrating machine learning into a creative production process, or also both a composition planning and production process. And this idea of having machine learning being part of a workflow where you partially manually are still active at the performer on stage, that's what Jan is doing with Double Vortex. And some aspects of the performance are being taken over by the machine learning object. So this shared responsibility between an automated process that is has limited sort of creative abilities in combination with human decision making. And I think that's something I would like to explore further. It's really sort of untapped in the sense that it's hard to get so easily access to machine learning algorithms, to integrate them in a performance, a technical setup for performance, and also to be able to experiment and compare different algorithms for your particular needs.
I have a conceptual development question. In the sense that now you've been working on this for several years, and I'm just curious to hear, because there are so many approaches to machine learning and to develop systems in this field, that if you were to start over now, would you have done anything differently than what you actually did in this project? Would you have tapped in a different place? Or I'm just curious to hear about the development phase.
And personally, I would have interested to not focus exclusively on gesture classification algorithms, but also on either regression algorithms, or if it's gesture classification algorithms only, then also use algorithms that do some unsupervised learning. Mm-hmm. At the moment, everything is supervised learning, so the training is fully controlled by the composer or whoever has designed the system. Mm-hmm. So in order, especially with respect to this idea of attributing more autonomy to the system, it would be interesting to also work with non-supervised learning.
And I mean, the structure that we have is open enough so that we can plug in other algorithms. So we're also thinking of the XMMs, Jules François, Fred's doctoral student. The question really is more on a conceptual level. So we have the technical infrastructure to use these algorithms. And I think we just need to spend X amount of time to get in an infrastructure like that if you want certain types of behavior. So for example, we did some technical decisions not to do everything in Max, for example, but really go into a more high performance environment, or to kind of build a modular system within a C++ environment that allows us to leverage other aspects of work. So for example, what we haven't talked about is the whole motion capture and movement analysis side of it, where we can actually plug in the machine learning tool into that. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally what I would have done differently is try to get a much bigger chunk of resources dedicated to that, because it's a lot of work. I think that's the first step, yeah.
And although we haven't done, I think, any comparative analysis concerning the qualities of cues that the machine learning systems really can learn, so the different machine learning systems can learn, and whether they are meaningful compared to the surveys you have been doing, that are human-based surveys, sort of assigning quantitative values to certain movement features, just as, yeah. We have done a lot of experiments concerning effort that will be talked in the psychology part, and there is no direct link between this research and what we've been doing in the machine learning part.
For lack of time, basically. Yeah. So I think that would be my answer to your question in terms of project organization. And I was anticipating a little bit that it would turn out this way, that's why I wanted to have the development done within a year, to be really able to just use it and deploy it. But of course, I think you cannot say that within a year you finish building a framework for applying it. I mean, this needs a lot more work. Yeah, Atal?
Yeah, so, well, it's my first meeting, so I probably have a lot of questions, and it's the first session. But maybe if we stay on the conceptual side, you showed a very, at the beginning, the different levels of data extraction.
Alexander's.
So, which level are you sending to the machine learning? Is it the raw data, or you said that the Laban effort isn't connected in yet, so it doesn't seem like you're sending in that level of abstraction to the machine learning algorithm. But are you sending in one of these intermediary representations? I mean, has there been segmentation taking place? Is there feature extraction that you're doing?
There is no automated segmentation taking place at the moment, and as far as I know, the sensory input is treated at all.
No, it is being treated, but mainly it's the transformation into a more useful kind of representation of the movement. So it stays on, I would say it's on the second or third layer without segmentation.
And what we also have been doing is like to queue machine learning algorithm, that you get sort of higher level data out of the first machine learning algorithm that's then being classified by a second one. Mm-hmm. So there's now deep learning here.
Yeah.
So some of us here are doing similar things. So for us, we hear the stories and they're familiar stories.
Yeah, of course.
Then at the same time, you try to make this usable for the artists. And obviously there's not just a problem of user interface, but of understanding these things. And so maybe an interesting area of discussion that connects the low-level technical side to the high-level conceptual side are the representations, you know, which could directly tie to feature extraction,
mm-hmm.
and what those might be. We find that finding good features is a very, very interesting problem. At the same time, finding good gestures is good, you know. So in fact, we've done the same thing. We've made a whole system, and then you say, okay, well, what do you put into it?
That's the big question, and in a way, these questions inform my compositional process from the beginning. That's why I came up with these moving primitives, where you can say, okay, so these you're certain to find, because I think the big discussion on gesture, especially in performance, is each type of performance will have a different gesturality.
Sure.
I think it's such a wide kind of also kind of a blurry definition. Each one becomes idiosyncratic.
Now this is only the first session, so probably sometime tomorrow we'll talk about what's next. And, but maybe what I imagine right away is that some future conversation could be about these.
Absolutely.
The experience that each of us brings to questions of gesture, which gesture, if gesture vocabulary, features, which combinations of features.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you, and I think that's one thing that to me is also, in a way, as important as the results, is more the methodological implications. So the things you learn about the method for the next edition, because then you can change your, you can refine your method. And then, of course, linking the different efforts. I mean, in a way, that's also why I'm happy that that you're participating, because that's exactly what you need in a project like this, is to have the outside view and kind of also other experiences. People who work differently bring in another experience. So
so now that I asked the conceptual question, I'll just ask the technical question.
Sure.
Okay, so you're training before the performance, and then do you keep a training set in between performances, or do you train just before each performance? How do you find the reusability of your training sets?
So the thing is, the training set is quite general and it's quite fuzzy, actually. Mm. So we found that overtraining it, so too specifically training it, makes it unusable, because there's no way you can, I mean, the chances of hitting those patterns. So we actually undertrain it in a way. And that gives a much wider field of recognition. It's more tolerant in a way, which then ties in with the idea that you want to give some agency to the system, so unpredictability. And of course, these are, let's say, quality criteria that are important to the artistic work, and to the scientific or more empirical work might actually be a fault or a failure. So I think that's...
And you said you're using GTK, is that right? Mm-hmm. Is that Nickelodeon's?
The gesture recognition toolkit. So that's the framework, and actually Chikashi's been building plugins for GVM, I mean the C++ thing, and we also want to get the Jules François tools also.
So it's a front end for all these algorithms that you've created.
Plus some infrastructure, I mean a framework in terms of also like IO
storage.
I mean that's what you always end up needing, right? Mm-hmm. Some kind of.
And did you look at Wakinator?
Yes, we did, of course. I mean, I'm well aware of Rebecca's work, and there were some conceptual problems we had with that. Mm-hmm. And, also, we're also interested in actually really taking the tools apart. Mm-hmm. So this for us is extendable, even if it looks like a finished thing. This is actually the code actually for us is still workable for other things like.
So is it open to for? Modification? Can we try it?
Sure. I mean, it's been published, and there's a repository that where you can download it, and it's still not finished, so there's still some few bugs and things. But I mean, it's all documented. The dependencies are clear, and I mean, the thing is, I would want to organize resources to start working on that again, also in terms of motion capture analysis. So do the kind of the marker set as an input for that, which is different than the body sensors.
Mm-hmm. So this part of the project is done now that Chikashi's contract is over.
Yeah,
I see. Okay.
Yeah. But I mean the code base is here, and it's still usable. Mm-hmm. And I'm still tweaking it. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's a question I would have. I mean, concerning the continuation of this code base, is there a documentation that we have, or we plan on meeting with Chikashi to really transfer? For instance, if I take fully over this, adding additional.
That's the thing, and I've been thinking we I don't know what the doxygen level is in that code, for example. So in source documentation, but Chikashi is quite good at. UML, so kind of structural things, so that helps a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because one of the more concrete plans that we have, we actually had it for this meeting, but slightly postponed, to transform this machine learning workbench into a system that allows to, also gives you more visualization and analysis possibilities of different kinds of data, and that allows you to create new sort of tracks, if you would call it tracks, on the fly based on the output of machine learning algorithms. that you really can sort of go through layers of interpretation of data.
Yeah, in a way, like a hybrid between RepoViz and this. I mean, RepoViz is interesting, but in terms of analysis, you get music information retrieval, and that's it. And so, kind of taking those ideas, but merging them in a C++ code base.
Yeah, I think that would be very useful. Kind of also tapping in on the mocap toolbox, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to see how all this could fit together.
So, there's some technical issues of blending MATLAB and C++, so that's...
Yeah, well, we have started Python porting of the mocap
tools. So that's the thing. I mean, I'm interested in having like a NumPy binding with C++. Mm-hmm. So that's a technical kind of... but then I'm not fit enough to, you know, pull that off, so I need some engineering skills too. But that would be interesting to have this kind of framework where you have these inputs and these capabilities and then have this back end of mocap toolbox or other. So for those who are not familiar with this, there's a whole technical research field that has to do with movement, mainly for like physiology and also medical, I think, and sports. And they apply scientific methods to kind of analyze these movements. But this is all done offline. None of this is real time. So, of course, for the stage, it's kind of...
It could be online. I mean, it's offline because people are working on analysis. Right?
Yeah, so exactly.
It's more about being how to make it online.
Yeah, exactly. So, to me, those are methodological questions, methodological challenges that I find interesting from the point of view as a musician. And of course, this is not our core field, so we need to import.
Well, so this idea of running these machine learning tools in real time and making them accessible to artists, opening up the black box in a way and making the data set perhaps editable, training throughout the performance, as you mentioned. These are all the kinds of things that are in the area, the broad area of interactive machine learning. And so whether you use my colleague Rebecca's Wekinator or not, this is an area that we've been developing quite a bit at Goldsmiths. And these are the things where I think performance does bring something new to the field of machine learning that the big data people and the data mining people don't regularly encounter. So it does create a very interesting context and interesting challenges in and of itself. Now, we are organizing a workshop in this area at the CHI conference in May.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So I hope you submitted something, because the deadline is over. But since I'm one of the co-organizers, and if you've missed the deadline and you want to submit something, maybe you can write me a check. It's a workshop, so it's quite casual. I don't know how many submissions we got, if there's spots, but it would be fantastic to have you guys join this conversation. The human-centered machine learning workshop is really what we've organized for the human computer interaction community, to present it, to bring that this interactive machine learning, this nascent community together. And so your work is directly relevant
I'm following from afar what is going on. So I was really looking also into Rebecca's work, her thesis work, and her pedagogical work as well, which I find really interesting.
You don't have to lurk. You could just, I know that you're doing this, but to see a proposal come in would be, I don't know if you feel like you have results ready to go, but it's, the workshop is a nice in-between point. It doesn't have to be publishable conference or journal material. It is a workshop, so we're organizing it to bring people together to show work in progress, to share experiences, and to try to bring together a community of people so that we can share not just knowledge, but maybe to consolidate players in a new field. Yeah.
No, I'll definitely get back to you on that. I mean, we'll have to discuss this. I was focusing a lot on the practical side, so in that sense, we published some of that last year already, so it's been kind of, it's settled down a bit. But I mean, I'm happy to, you know, I mean, you look it up and you tell me what the status is, and then
yeah.
I'm happy to kind of bring in something, and we can talk more about what we've done,
mm-hmm.
which might actually be interesting, and bring the data sets that we have, you know, which might also be interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because mm-hmm. so I mean, there are new toolboxes popping up all the time,
mm-hmm.
but again, it's also interesting to hear about the toolboxes that have lived for a little while and that are being used,
yeah.
and how they're being used and what should have been made differently.
Yeah.
That type of thing is very useful, I think.
I think that's the age-old problem of development, is it's not finished when you've done
mm-hmm.
the technical work. The application takes, I mean, it's like instrument building. Once you've built the instrument, you have to practice it. And that's usually long, a lot more time than the actual development.
Yeah.
So in that sense.
Yeah, to open it to more use cases.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment
yeah.
we have, it's only us who has been using the system.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's in an ideal world, it gets dispersed and gets picked up and gets reused and then it starts growing. I know from other projects that this is it's not so easy. It doesn't just happen by itself. So, but I mean, the discussions we've had last year with the Lachenmann motion capture
mm-hmm.
and this two papers I've published on that and a little bit of work I've done on that. That's also just scratching the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And the motion repositories that there are. I mean, for our field, it's only usable to a limited amount because it's usually just 5 seconds of violin playing or somebody running. And this is like using it in the wild, so it's much more complex.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the issues, in a way.
And also for people to bring this kind of results more into educational context. That performers sort of get an idea of what our goal is and maybe can also try to work with this system or similar systems. So it's become more sort of an awareness for the availability of these kind of tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not exactly consumer ready, but...
No, but that's a context question.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a question in which context you use it and you deploy it. And of course, in the university context or in the research context, it's not so much about dissemination, it's more about development. Improving the tools,
yeah.
but then in a way for longevity it would be about dissemination.
Mm-hmm.
I think. So what is the status of a mocap toolbox Python? Do you know anything specific?
Well, I have a master's student working on it.
Okay.
It's supposed to be finished this spring. We'll see.
Okay, so do
but the, what we're also doing there, we're also extending it in a way that we are really trying to make containers that can handle both audio, video, and mocap at the same time. So we're really trying to solve that,
yeah.
that as well, because for now these are always handled separately, right? I mean, like the mocap toolbox, the media toolbox, and the, also the media toolbox there.
Yeah.
I guess Olivier is working on this new toolbox now, Olivier and Antonio. Which is supposed to do things even more complicated, but
thank you very much.
We are taking the other perspective
yeah.
and trying to kind of make it.
No, I mean, what I realize is that the multimodal mixture of is actually the most meaningful, but it's also the hardest
mm-hmm.
because I mean, first of all, you have technical issues, but then also conceptually of weighing those different channels,
mm-hmm.
and in that sense, RepoVis is also just, you know, a first step in a sense of, you know, okay, now we can bring that together, but it's not really going a step further. So
well, RepoVis is doing the visualization nicely, but again, it's still, I mean, if you want to work with the data, it's you need to look at, well, there's a lot of other issues.
Well, they have an MIR backend where they do stuff on the server, but that's not, you know, really multimodal in itself. So.
Mm.
And for me, really, the question is what is the goal of the application, and that's why our statement is we want to apply this in performance. So this is our well, use case, or this is our context, our native context is to put it on stage. But that's just one way of looking at it. And of course, you know, if you want to do movement analysis or even cross-modal analysis, then it's maybe more appropriate for lab work.
So is your workbench running as a piece of software during the performance?
Yeah, it is. So tonight we'll be running on my laptop, during the trombone piece.
Yeah. Now with the multimodal approach, doing both audio and motion analysis, or
this is motion only.
This is motion.
Which was also kind of a conceptual decision to have the performer work on the sound and on movement. Mm. And the tasks are, some of the tasks are movement as well. Mm. But the machine only sees the movement.
And also, it's of course, because of the project scope, the movement is the main criteria that we want to address with machine learning. And the next obvious step outside of the project is, of course, to expand it to all the modalities and also acoustic modalities.
The issue being really that you get these higher order feature streams that become really difficult to handle. And also you need a very stable setup for that. And so on a pragmatic side, it's just you take one channel and that can be stabilized. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you mix the different channels like video and audio and motion information, that becomes very hard to stabilize over longer periods of time. And I mean, we've been working with this for like not quite 18 months, maybe 16 months now. Mm-hmm. And it's been quite, I mean, from the beginning, and it's been kind of stable, which is also, for practical reasons, really important.
Is this the turning piece, or?
No, it's the other trombone, the trombone piece.
One, yes.
That has evolved, I mean, it has changed, but. So, anybody else wants to contribute, question?
Will you shed light on later on, probably, on the actual relationship of the motion analysis and the outcome of that, and how that feeds or informs the performer's playing and practice? You probably will, I guess.
We will talk a little bit about that. And bring back that question once we do.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
I think that we can talk about.
Because it was a really interesting process for me, how to work with these machine learning tools. And actually, I think I ignore them. I just listen. First, I try to control them, and this was not possible, of course, because it was made fuzzy and uncontrollable. But I try to find gestures that influence the system. And this wasn't useful in a musical way.
Okay.
And so I just listened what comes from the computer, but it also wasn't always sure if it's the machine learning decision or is it your decision, but it doesn't important. Mm-hmm. It's not important.
And that has changed
in
the last year. Mm-hmm. The beginning was different than it is now.
Yeah.
So this is also interesting how these relationships change.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think we'll get to this.
Yeah,
for me as well. I think these kind of influences are cyclical.
Yeah.
So that's, okay, so I think we'll leave it at that. Like I said, we scratched the surface, and I'm happy to engage more. Also, we can discuss this on the side a little bit more. Future work. So, looking at the schedule, I think Patrick is next.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Slides,
yeah, it's perfectly fine. I can also give you the slides.
Okay. Better.
Yeah. Easier. Higher resolution.